Episode 34. Episode number 34. Consistently above average is here. Now, I have to say, this has been recorded Wednesday morning. This episode was started Friday night. This episode was going to be, first of all, it was going to be Friday night leading into the Irish Open. Then we had Irish Open, had to be there very early. I was like, I can't stay up until 3, 4 o'clock in the morning doing this. Between all the editing and everything, I was like, an Irish Open recap will be better. That'll be grand. Absolutely bollocksed after the Irish Open. The following day, we had your fighting championships in Newry. And then we go back into the Monday-Tuesday cycle. This podcast was significantly easier to do when I could just sit here like a little gremlin talking by myself, not having to worry about how I look. I know you're thinking, well, you look terrible. You've only just woke up. It's Wednesday morning. And not having to worry about the camera, different things like that. However, the end is in sight. Tomorrow morning, according to DHL, tomorrow morning, we have a beautiful delivery arriving, a brand new MacBook, things that will be able to change the setup to make it a lot more efficient to record directly in. We also have another big delivery coming on Friday, which you are going to see on Instagram, of which there are no smalls, just for the record, in this particular drop, but there will be smalls very soon. The first one is very, very, very limited, but the style is not going to change. That's all I'm going to say. Keep an eye out. We're very excited. I can't wait to get them. The quality is unbelievable. But the thing that threw me on Friday as well, my dad was coming back. He flew into Belfast instead of Dublin because the flight was cheaper into Belfast than Dublin. My dad is an expert at finding cheaper flight travel. And me and my mate flew up to Belfast International Airport to collect him. A terrible road, a terrible, terrible way to get to an airport. So we were back very late then on Friday and it just threw everything off. But what I had noticed by looking on Instagram, a friend of mine was on tour recently. The expression friend is a loose expression there. So we have met, if we were to pass each other in the street, we'd be chatting. We've trained together before. Someone I am friendly with, thanks to Jiu-Jitsu, who is abroad, he was on tour with a band as a personal trainer. And he had been doing sessions with them in hotel gyms, traveling, sleeping on very nice tour buses in between gigs, going all around the UK. And while I was clicking through some of his stories and posts that he had shared, I went on to one of them and I saw a sympathetic or supportful comment from the account titled Scouting for Girls. Now, I can genuinely say it's not a band that I have thought about in a very long time, but at one point in time, they were huge. We went to see them as teenagers in Dublin and it was absolutely packed. By all accounts at the time, for the style of the time, it was a great gig. So I clicked into their page, see what they're at the moment. They have a big tour around the UK and Ireland next year. And while they have released a lot of albums over the last 10 years or so, there's nothing that has pierced the public attention like their early work did at the time, which you probably had on MP3 players, iPod shuffles, iPod minis, iPod videos, iPods, whatever. Okay, before Spotify became the dominant thing. But it made me think and want to look up about their lead singer. Oh my God, there's a huge wasp after coming in here beside me.
This could be a ropey episode here, I tell you.
Nope. All good. Their lead singer, Scouting for Girls, is a guy called Roy Stride. So I thought, what is he at now? He's 46 years old. The peak of his powers came throughout his 20s, which would have been mental for the brain, for the senses, for the lifestyle. Playing sold out gigs, being high on the charts, traveling the world, a full-blown celebrity. He's 46 years old now and enjoys supporting local breweries, has two kids and is married, lives by all accounts a quiet life, but I would guess he just about got into the musical industry towards the phasing out and relevance of like physical CD buying, which probably would have made them a lot more money just in that area than if they had to come in a few years later and were relying on streaming. I used to love on a Saturday afternoon going up to the Marshes, and there was a HMV, then it became Zavvy, or maybe it was something else, then it became Zavvy, then it became HMV. I can't remember, Golden Discs back in the day as well, and buying CDs. Just behind us here, there's a little, it's called an eave, not an attic, because the attic was converted into my bedroom when I was younger, or bedrooms when I was younger. And in there, I'd say I have three big plastic boxes just full of CDs. And it made me think, I actually don't have anything in this house capable of playing any of those CDs, nor the DVDs that are in the one underneath it. So this man, Roy, has hit the jackpot, surely. Like, made the money through the CDs, made the money through when it was a little bit more profitable. Now, as nostalgia kicks in the next couple of years or so, there'll be a demand for them to do even more tours, because the people who grew up with them listening to their music will now all have kids, responsibilities, families, mortgages, all of these things, and they'll do anything to get a night away in a hotel and go to a concert that reminds them of their youth. And it links into something that I had saw earlier on in the week. It was really fascinating to me. Those know I'm involved with a radio project called 8radio.com, or who might know. 8radio is an online station based in Dublin. I've been involved with it for 12 years now, since I was in college. The founder is a guy called Simon Marr. He was my lecturer in Ballyfermot. Simon helped me massively through college. I would attribute him being a huge reason for me wanting to stay there, his teaching style, how he interacted with people, what he was able to teach us, his demeanor, his kindness, his friendliness, just top 10 out of 10 human. The type of person that you've never heard a bad word spoken about. And I was playing this band, or they came up when I was on a show during the week, and I was thinking, where have I seen them recently? So there was a group called All American Rejects, described as alt-rock or pop-punk or emo-punk or whatever you have in yourself. Notable tracks of theirs may have appeared on an old-school MP3 or iPod of yours. They could include, but not limited to, Gives You Hell, Swing Swing, Dirty Little Secret, or Move Along. So I was just seeing what they were at, because I saw an Instagram video a few days previously, and they're doing something very differently in America. So they're doing what they are calling a house party tour, okay? Tyson Ritter is the lead singer, and they have put up like 50 grand of their own money to help finance this tour in terms of paying their crew, their tour, their travel, all of this. They're doing a Ron Seal here. They're doing exactly what it says on the tin. They're playing at house parties. They are literally showing up to random places, alerting people through messaging email lists that people have subscribed to, and they're putting on these gigs. Now, I am going to insert in a little bit of a clip here, a particularly impassioned speech at a local bowling alley, of course, on why they are doing it. I'm going to play it for you just now.
This band, if you found this band when you were in your fucking Huggies and just now seeing us for the first time, I want to thank you for coming out. Support a rock and roll band that gives a shit about the common man. We're not trying to sell you finance tickets to Coachella. We're not trying to sell you Ticketmaster fucking penalty fees. We're not trying to sell you $25 parking. We're just trying to sell you some songs you might have grew up with and let you fucking let go with us in this non-denominational church of rock and roll.
So while this seems like a great idea, giving back to the fans, taking it away from the big arenas, the man, the ticket masters. I was looking it up on Reddit, and one Redditor has chimed in with where this whole idea came from. So if you want to know what really started this, it was the When We Were Young Music Festival. The first year they had it, the wind cancelled it. So 150,000 displaced emos were super sad in Las Vegas that day. Bands were scrambling to book shows all over the city to make their fans happy. I shit you not, that day was like Nick and Nora's Infinite Playlist, where they drive all over New York to see different bands, only it was in Las Vegas. Hawthorne Heights had the first pop-up show in the Strat Casino at like noon. 20 to 30k emos rushing the casino, making Vegas police come in and shut the whole place down. We really wanted to see Senses Fail on Thursday, and a few other bands play at the Silver Dollar at the Plaza. It was right across from our hotel at Golden Gate Casino, but by 3pm the line was 5k deep. I'd been in the Silver Dollar before. It's a 500 person venue tops. All American Rejects was one of the many bands that did a pop-up show. Most of the bands went for massive venues, but they picked a barbecue joint in the Art District. It was another venue that could only hold about 300 people, and the show was amazing. The venue then had thousands of fans who couldn't get in that were standing outside, so All American Rejects basically was stuck in there and hung out to take pictures with everyone, tell them all how sorry they were for the concert being cancelled. While I sat at that bar listening to All American Rejects, I realised that the barbecue joint took over an old bar rescue look at blah, 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 blah. So, first of all, first thoughts on that. A load of black-clothed emos, long, sweaty-haired emos running around Las Vegas in the sweltering heat. That's hilarious. That's a sight within itself. Okay, I'm on board with that to begin with. But there is something incredibly genuine and heartwarming about this story, because nostalgia is such a valuable thing. All right, it's not a currency or whatever. Maybe it'll become a meme coin in the future, but it is something people do yearn for. And it's something like people do, like I said, in the value of those tours or whatever. This might sound like something that your mother would have shared on Facebook from a page or a graphic years ago before memes were actually a thing, but they would just share stuff like, you're never too old to come to my house for your dinner, or you can always bring your clothes to be washed here. You're never too old to come back to my house, son, blah, blah, blah. But cliche as it is, you did not know the last time your family sat at the kitchen table for a dinner together was the last time you would all do that. You never knew the time that you climbed over the wall up the road in the boys' club to play football with your mates was going to be the last time you would all do that. Or played FIFA together, or me losing a terrible amount of money to my mates playing FIFA. From the sense of the All-American Rejects, the people going to these tours or the house party gigs, they're longing for drinking liquor or sinking a couple of beers out of those red plastic cups that you would have seen in movies. Like on Jarrett's lawn, Jarrett's huge lawn, or at the frat house. Like, they want to transport themselves back in time to when they were listening to that band at the height of their powers, and to try and recreate the scenario of how they used to listen to that particular band. In addiction services, as if I am qualified to talk about this as an actual person who could teach this, I'm not, but it's something that I did learn. It's called euphoric recall. Euphoric recall is one of the biggest things that people chase when they're looking for something, whether it's a hit, a high, or whatever. They are remembering a certain time when something was going well, and that's what they're trying to chase. For me, it was smoking joints in Vegas after big McGregor fights, when like there was adrenaline in your body. You'd been over there, you'd been on it, you'd seen it. You're the other side of the world. You're standing outside the MGM casino. It's a lovely evening. There's people going by in GAA jerseys going mad. Like, that was the thing for me. So maybe for these emos, it was wanting to listen to All American Rejects with red paper cups and studded belts and stuff like that, right? So there is no big red warning button that tells you this is the last one. So let's link that into jiu-jitsu. And with the Irish Open during the weekend, it made me think of this stuff massively. It's all linked together. Ryan McCartney was my best training partner for years. Ryan and I, very close friends. We would drill together as blue belts, like morning time, copying stuff that he had learned from training in Marcelo Garcia's when he was over in New York. We would train in the mornings before there were proper morning classes. We would be drilling. We'd be going to tournaments over in the UK, down around the country, going to the Europeans. And then it made me think about the classes and stuff like that, like how busy the Wednesday night class used to be in particular, when another friend, enemy of the podcast, Paul McCourt, and others would come down from Belfast to train with Seb. It was a, like an average mixed levels class now would have a higher standard. But the nostalgia, like I'm talking about it as a currency, like you never knew when the last good training session with everyone as blue and purple belts was before life and different things started pulling people in other directions that meant the Wednesday wasn't viable. Timetable change had to happen. This happened, new job, whatever. You're down three people. Oh, it's still okay. Then you're down four people and then you feel it changing. And then another day becomes the main session of the week that people would have to try and prioritize to try and get to. And I really felt the same way at the Irish Open, like feeling very nostalgic, at least from our perspective, while having a phone call with somebody on the way home. Like 14 or 15 people I train with went to the Irish Open. This is between Dundalk and Uri. Now, competition is not something that we have been massively pushing over the last little while. I'm not speaking out of turn or out of place. The focus of the gym swapped to MMA over the last couple of years, and that's perfect because they're doing quite well. There's a lot of people involved in that and want to be doing it. It's not like any like mad gi competition people went from that, went from only doing that to MMA. It's not the case. It's nearly like maybe with, like I'm talking about these people, schedules changing, growing up, dropping out, moving away, sort of thing, that they weren't actually replaced with the people who would go to compete. There is a small group now that would go and compete fairly consistently over the course of the year, but we do not put a major push outside of mentioning it that the Irish Open is happening, tournament in Uri is happening, tournament in Belfast is happening at the end of competition training on a Saturday. But I do think that the consequence of this is that at some of the classes, like competition class, or where we have a lot more positional, situational sparring, rounds of sparring, that leads to people wanting to consider competing because they're training hard, training in a certain way, and then they want to try and test themselves after having done that work. So it's like, I would not be pushing, oh, you should be doing the Irish Open, and then being on someone. And there's a part of me thinking like, maybe I should, but at the end of the day, people will compete for their own reasons. And it's nearly like you can create the environment for them to want to compete. And then when they do compete, they realize I actually enjoy this. I want to do more of them. And then it kind of spirals like that. But I was reminded of a time when there was more, essentially. It was more of a day out. There was more of us there. There was multiple people bundling into cars to go to these tournaments. And there is an argument to be made that the oversaturation of competitions to a degree in Ireland now makes it feel like, while the Irish Open is the one with the big name and they broke all their records, they had the most amount of people doing it that they've ever done it before, it was the biggest Irish Open in history, it might not be the big one in priority to people around the country anymore. So yes, it was there in numbers. I feel there could have been hundreds more that could have done it under different circumstances. We have talked at length in the past that some people might value what they're getting for and their money's worth as the contributing factor towards what they're doing for tournaments. Do they want to do a round robin? Do they want to do the one that's only a 30-minute drive, an hour away? Do they have to take the full day off or the night off before, not get home until late that night, spend more money? To these people, it could be as simple as how many of their favorite other training partners are going to head away for the tournament that day. And it can also be down to the fact that maybe the gym's expectations have increased over the years and they realize now it's feasible for them to be winning Masters Europeans titles or European titles, and that's what they're going to prioritize more than an Irish Open title. An Irish Open title to one gym can mean a lot more than to another gym, and that's not to slander the top gym or to diminish the bottom gym. It's still an Irish Open title. I think for the first time, and I could be wrong about this, for the first time since Ryan McCartney in 2015 or 2016, Carl Moore would have won it as a purple belt at the Nogi one. I think Team Torres had an adult coloured belt absolute winner. Dylan Nooney won it actually at brown belt as well. But again, not to slander that achievement, there's far less people doing brown belt than there is doing blue belt. So we had a blue belt absolute winner. at the weekend in the Gi and a beaten finalist in Nogi. Same guy, he nearly got double gold. That's the first time since Ryan McCartney nearly 10 years ago, as far as I know. So to me, that's a sign pushing in the right direction, able to win the harder divisions, the bigger divisions, the more competitive numbers-wise divisions. But if we're going back to like logistically being a thing, travel is what brings this in a lot. Now, there's exceptions to the rule, and I said it to him at the weekend, to Barney from Hill and Gracie. I think the fact that they have the furthest distance to travel from Donegal and last year won Gi and Nogi in the overall team titles, one of the members cheekily described Barney to me as like a politician looking for re-election, the way he was canvassing the members towards competing at the Irish Open. But you can see it in all of their coaches being there both days, long days, the groups and the crowds and the support that they have, the competitors that they have. It's insane. They have 7 or 8 people at every mat cheering on an athlete. And it is so, so good to see. Some of them, if not a lot of them, went down the night before, paid for a hotel, stayed there. They prioritize this tournament. And to me, I think that is such a good thing. It's here's the catch 22, right? Tournaments now are insanely more efficient, especially with something like Smooth Comp. In an ideal old school kind of way, you would organize a bus. Everyone agrees to meet up at the gym at 6 or 7 in the morning. Everyone is transported in one go. After the last person has competed, you all head back on the bus. Like before the world of Smooth Comp, that would have been a much more likely thing because the times were uncertain. But now you wake up in the morning of the tournament, you check your phone, you'll see almost to the minute what time you're going to be competing at. So if you're not competing until 4 o'clock, why would you be getting up at 6 in the morning to go on the bus? This is the thing that I think that we're actually losing from it. The team element, the support element, the day out element, because it's a lot. Jiu-Jitsu is an individual sport. Don't get me wrong. You compete by yourself, but you train with your team. You get better because of your team. And in particular, I was very happy to see so many people from us hang around until the end, or even people who weren't competing come up to watch matches, to watch other people compete that they train with. Thankfully, they did that. The streams went kaput about an hour into the day, so they weren't able to watch it online regardless. But even if it is only in a smaller number, let's limit that to like 8, 9, or 10, I was very happy to think that there is something kind of building momentum-wise. The result of the people from Masters and Adults will now hopefully encourage others. And we didn't do too bad in the overall sense of the Irish Open. We really didn't. But I do think we could do much better. And I do think that we could win the Adult Male Gi, Masters Male Gi, and the overall award next year, assuming they keep it at the same criteria for what they give it this year. So it was different this year compared to last year. Hopefully it stays the same way for next year, doesn't throw a banana skin in the way. But let's just throw a banana skin, another one, favorite word of mine today, into this discussion for a minute. So they didn't actually release the number, but somebody told me it was 1,498 paid registrations. I don't know if that's true or not. I'm just saying someone who had checked like the source code of the registration page, being able to filter it by approved paid for registrations. I think 1,498 was the figure. This is a slight increase on the last 2 or 3 years of Irish Opens. I do think that we're going to see it surpass 2,000 registrations in the next couple of years, which would be great. But this year, compared to last year's Irish Open, was night and day in the difference. Night and day better in the difference. It was back at the Sport Ireland campus, number one. And honestly, even if this is just me, this feels like something that's really important. I'm saying this as someone who's not only competed there as an athlete, but also who has coached there too. Jiu-Jitsu is not an Olympic sport. Submission grappling is not an Olympic sport. There's no pathway to the higher level. We are not even a recognized sport in this country. There is no professional level really available in this country. There are people who commit to this sport of Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu to a higher level of commitment than professional rugby players who, between me and you, allegedly and apparently, are some of the most laziest, undisciplined professional athletes going. I'm using professional in quote marks there because do they derive 75% or more of their income from something? That is the definition of professional. Professional is just a rule set in many degrees. A professional boxer is it's a rule set. Professional mixed martial arts is a rule set. But stuff like professional rugby, professional football, or soccer, those things are people who are deriving an income from doing them. Okay, so that's the definition that I'm going to make there. And I will double down, triple down, quadruple down, if you even want me to, that there are people who commit to the sport of Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu in terms of their diet, their discipline, their training, their study, their sleep, their schedule, the money that they spend to go and compete, to get better, seminars, study, online study, all of these things. They commit to a higher level than the professional sport athlete who trains once and then does nothing with the rest of their day. There are jiu-jitsu athletes who are higher in commitment level than professional rugby players, professional soccer players, high-level GAA players, and perhaps to a degree, even Olympians, especially if you want to bring into the thought process that we talked about last week, that town planning is an Olympic discipline. So you could find what you consider to be the easiest thing to win an Olympic gold medal in. You can admit that it's an incredibly difficult skill to get good at, but are they having to do the same level of commitment? Pains in the body, aches in the body, X, Y, and Z, as someone like, say, Stuart Carmody, who's over in California going to do Worlds after being in Athos for the last couple of months. So, that's a big call. I understand it. The professionals draw a wage, but others get use of that facility. They get their sports psychologists paid for, they get their physio done, they get their strength and conditioning done, they get their training plans, they get warm weather training camps abroad paid for, they get sponsorships and subsidiaries. So to have your sport, to have the national tournament of your sport, to be on that national sporting campus in the place where I feel that it should be, in the place where one day hopefully there will be a Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu national team, where there will be something on the Sport Ireland campus where young athletes will be able to benefit from these sort of things in the future. To me, having it there is like the early footprint of that happening. And I really think that any national tournament moving forward, you can move the date to whatever time in the year you have to, as long as it happens on that campus. Okay? That is important. And I could be entirely wrong about that. I don't know if other coaches feel the same way about that. I feel like it's a big deal. Now, let's talk about the ref, okay? Much better this year. Much, much, much better. The IB, the Irish Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu crowd flew in referees from abroad. Six of them, I believe, six officials. That's good. Now, there's always going to be a ref or two who slipped through the net in terms of them being old school or whatever. And there was a couple that I seen. There was one that I was pretty furious with at the time. Someone I trained with got spiked on their head. And I was furious because I thought it was fairly obvious that, like, he got picked up from an armbar and dropped down onto his head. And the ref did nothing. Just looked at it. Now, you could argue that, let's say, that guy got hurt. Okay. Well, then nothing could have been done about it anyway. The ref would have stopped it, but the guy still would have been hurt. But, like, I don't like some of them calls of, like, a person being lifted up in closed guard and putting their back and it's called a slam. That's a grey area. Someone being dropped on their head while they're doing an armbar to someone is as clear-cut of an instant disqualification as you could get. And the referee had no time, didn't even acknowledge me, saying, is that a spike? Is that not a slam? What's happening here? Blah, blah, blah. But the other thing that embarrassed me, the other thing that caught me, someone I respect massively called me out for something from coaching at the weekend. And this was the situation I've written out. Okay. Now, an athlete was pulling a teammate of mine closer to the boundary while they were on top. My teammate had a single leg X lapel guard type position. I told the teammate, stop and hold the position. You'll get reset in the middle, which he did. He looks at the referee. The referee looks back at him. There's no reset. Now, he is right on the boundary. If you are in a position close to the edge that can be reset in the center, the refs are going to do that 10 times out of 10. That is a rule. That's in the IBJJF rulebook, that you will get reset if it's not in transition, if it's safe to do so. It was a draw at this point. Had my teammate have swept the guy, he wouldn't have got the points for it because it would have went out of bounds. So it would have been an advantage in reset in the middle, given as an advantage only. So I then say to the referee, can we get a reset in the center, please? The athletes are stalled and it's close to the edge of the mat. The ref looks at me, turns and looks at me in the middle of the match like I just ran over his dog. Like picked his dog up, then picked the carcass up and threw it across the road into the face of another car. Like this chap was not happy. Then he starts like shaking his head to himself like this, like making a big deal of it, like shaking his head to himself. When I said, can we get a reset in the center, please? When I said it again. Now, this can happen. Right, they're the man in the arena, they're the big guy, they're the alpha, they're the whatever. With about 45 seconds left, my teammate puts on a loop choke from close guard that made the guy on top struggle, react, and actively escape from the position. A viable submission threat. No advantage given. I encourage the teammate, you're going to have to work a lot harder on your next attempt because the ref didn't think that was an advantage. For whatever reason, he doesn't think that's an advantage. You have to go again. Now, probably sounded like a bit of an arsehole because you're belittling the referee's interpretation. But at this point, that referee had already made his mind up about me as a coach because I asked for a reset in the middle. And I tell you what, I didn't curse. I didn't swear. I wasn't being like, fuck's sake, referee. Fuck, what are you doing, ref? What are you doing? Blah, blah, blah. None of that, right? Neutral, basic, as best as possible, but probably on the condescending side when it came to that loop choke thing. Hold my hands up at that, right? He ends up getting the loop choke, puts him on his back, gets the advantages, then wins the match. Okay, but that would have been won, in my opinion, a lot earlier if the ref had to give us that reset that we were asking for so he could hit the sweep from the center. Now, it was pointed out to me by the person that I respect a lot that if that was a draw, there was no way my teammate was going to get the decision and the ref would have given it against him because of how I was coaching. They're human too. They're going to have biases. They're going to perceive, they're going to be slighted and weighted one way or another because they have to make the choice of who's going to get the decision of who wins. And it's not going to be for the person who's been yapping from the side. Now, I get that and I did feel like an arsehole afterwards because truth be told, I've seen that happen a lot and it's frustrating. And from my perspective, coaching at the weekend, I feel like incredibly neutral, like supportive of the athlete, like not demeaning the other athlete or the referee, letting the athlete know the time left, letting them know the rules, letting them know what's about to score for them, reminding a referee that a pass to the mount is 7 points, 3 for the pass, 4 for the mount. Back mount, something as well that was missed out on, but not a big deal. Why I feel comfortable in doing that or in interacting that way or in speaking that way is because less than 7 days previously, I spoke with the head European ref of the IBJJF and I got to ask him a couple of questions. I assume he is the head referee. His name is Kevin. So I said to him regarding the use of VAR, I said, I don't want to sound like an asshole when coaching during the matches. Regarding resets and asking for things to be checked, how do you want us to ask those things? Because previously, before you introduced this technology and some of the referees were wearing earpieces at the weekend. I don't think it was for VAR. I think it was for training. So fair enough, VAR wasn't in play at the Irish Open. But like previously, when it was down to referee's interpretation, you didn't want to be getting on the bad side of the referee by being like, oh, you're missing this, you're missing that. I said, so now that you have VAR, what's the way that you want us to go about that? I said, I know as an athlete, you can't speak to the referee. You'll get a penalty for that. He said, they actively want you to ask for the VAR checks. He said, we actively want, that was his word, we actively want coaches, if they think something needs to be checked on VAR during the match, to let the referee know during the match, because after the match, it can't be checked. And it stops people complaining afterwards, pulling up a phone saying, how did you miss this? How did you miss that? Everything is video too. So if you're asking and the ref isn't doing that or asking the side table for a separate judgment, then you have the footage of them ignoring the coaches, which is a bigger issue for the IBJJF in itself, because they've spent all this money on the VAR system, that if a referee is thinking, I'm above using this system, that is a bigger problem for them than a coach asking for something to be checked. Please ask for the adjustments, ask for the resets, ask for the checks. We have signals and signs to indicate that we are checking on the VAR, tapping their ear, and you'll see them going onto their microphone, and then points can be awarded after the fact for when they need to be. So, even with me giving that one isolated example of that ref, they flew in a lot of refs this year, which is an expense, which is essential, which is needed. Flew them in, paid them, put them up. Okay? Huge, huge, huge improvement on last year. Cannot praise Ireland BJJ enough for that. A lot of the refs you would see from the UK, from the AJP circuit, from the IBJJF circuit were brought in, and it is excellent. One particular podcast listener told me as well on the day that a previous bit of advice that was given on an older episode of this podcast stopped them from being disqualified. He was DQ'd after being called out twice on the speaker. He was cutting weight, he was warming up. He had a teammate of his that was being called out for over an hour and it was still being called. So he thought, they've only called me twice. I have time to keep cutting weight, to keep warming up. One of the mat coordinators, which they were probably told to do, so it's no problem, were trying to keep things running smoothly as possible ahead of schedule. Thanks to Smooth Comp, they wanted to go quicker. But to call a boring spade, if this tournament, again, being a bit of a perchant, if that's the word. No, not perchant, but stickler. Being a bit of stickler for the rules here. This tournament is running under the IBJJF rules. So we are subject to that on our gi checks, on our uniform, on our conduct, on the rules, on the points, the format, everything else. So per the IBJJF rules, even if it's not one that they say out on the website, it's something that I've checked with multiple referees and organisers over the last year. If your division is running ahead of schedule and you are both in the bullpen, checked in, weighed in and ready to go, they can choose to run your match early. They will run your match early. Let's say you're meant to be in four matches time, but the people aren't ready ahead of you, or someone is getting a rest from a match that has just happened. If you and your opponent are in the bullpen, you will be ran. If one is not in the bullpen, they can't choose to disqualify you because they wanted to keep things moving. So, to DQ you from a tournament, an IBJJF tournament, 5 to 10 minutes maximum must be given to you after the stated time of your match that was given to you at the start of the day. It's why at the IBJJF you can see people working off printed sheets of papers and not off phones. If I was meant to be competing at 1 o'clock in an IBJJF Dublin Open, they couldn't disqualify me until about 10 past one, even if the tournament was running so far ahead of schedule that they would have liked me to compete at 10 past 12. They cannot DQ you until 5 to 10 minutes after the stated time of your match. It's because the printed paper has the predetermined arranged start time. That's the one that matters. He brought this up with the worker who couldn't understand him. Didn't understand much of what this fellow was saying. I don't know if they didn't train jiu-jitsu. I don't know if it's because he was from the north and his accent was hilarious. Maybe it could have been those things. So he had been disqualified by this guy. He then asked to speak to an organizer. I don't know what organizer he spoke to, but he repeated what I'm after saying back to the organizer. The organizer admitted, that's right, undisqualified him, allowed him to compete, and then he won gold. Perfect. This is just an example of not being an arsehole. You've paid your money, know your rights, know the rules, know the format. This competitor, this turned one, just knowing this one thing, turned one competitor's experience with the competition from an incredibly sour one, i.e., I dieted, I cut weight, I prepared for the tournament, I took the day away from my kids, I drove to Dublin, I got disqualified because I was called twice while I was warming up. Instead of that happening and that being his experience, it's now I had a great day, I became an Irish champion, I'll be back to spend more money next year at your tournament, and I will actively encourage more of my teammates to come back next year and spend more money. This is a far better outcome and solution and scenario, hands down. And it only happened because that guy was a little bit prepped, thanks to consistently above average. We love to see it. We love to hear it. So from me, the biggest complainer in the Irish BJJ podcasting landscape, this event was brilliant. I was only there Saturday. I didn't compete myself on Sunday. I was working at an MMA event on Sunday. If you threw a carrot in the form in front of me of there's X amount of travel packages or something on the line for black belts, then I could have tried to make it work. But we would have probably seen a lot more black belts competing as well, I guess. But the reality is I just had a pre-arranged commitment on the Sunday. I will always prioritize that particular work over competing in jiu-jitsu. The two-day tournament, I feel, is probably the best format for the tournament. Ideally, if you put a gun to my head, the best format would be 8 major tournaments per year. 6 of them are of lower importance or standing, like the Emerald Cup or the Shamrock Cup or whatever. Then you have a Gi Irish Open and then you have a No Gi Irish Open. And I would rather them at separate times of the year on separate days. Now, that is only from a biased coaching perspective of trying to prepare people for the Irish Open and not having to compete both on the same day. However, running them on the same day and weekend keeps the costs down. It keeps it running a bit smoother. Less things to go wrong. If you can pull off the tournament on one day, well, then you don't have to worry about trying to pull it off on 2 days at separate times in the year. It's just for me, as an ideal world, as a coach, I feel you could rally more people to prepare for a no-gi Irish Open and then a gi Irish Open than trying to, like, some people would only do one, they wouldn't do both, but if they were at different times, they would do both. Because you might only see people X amount of times a week, and trying to prepare people to do the biggest competition in the country, your national competition, to a degree, essentially in two different types of sports, hours apart from each other, is quite difficult. But the main thing is that we have such a high standard tournament now that's ran well as the main tournament, but I do respect and understand why it doesn't suit so many people to compete at it geographically. Okay, grappling industries this weekend, the numbers will be interesting to see how many people sign up with the round robin value side of things only a week after the Irish Open. But fair play to those who either paid to stay up in Dublin or had two very long days of traveling, competing, coaching, kids, teens, juveniles, adults, masters, whatever. So to keep that in mind as we finish off, the number of athletes registered does include those who do not pay on the day or on time. So this is just a couple of things. They have not been excluded from the registration list. I was going to go into like a load of different stuff here, but I do need to finish up a little bit quicker. We might go into it more in the future, but Checkmat won the overall affiliation trophy on the day. So this is what I was saying. It was different compared to last year. There was an overall affiliation trophy for the first time. Last year it was just gi and no gi overall teams, and there was juveniles and whatever. This year there was juveniles, gi and no gi, or kids, gi and no gi, women's, gi and no gi, adults, gi and no gi, masters, gi and no gi, and affiliation overall. So Checkmat got first with 800 points. East Coast came second with Checkmat had 802. East Coast had 800. Team Rhino was in third. I'm not sure the points that Team Rhino had. But I was looking at all of the win-loss ratios and stuff like that. And I was going to do a big thing like this affiliation had 119 registered athletes. This had 199 registered athletes. But that doesn't separate the amount of people who didn't pay. So there's no point in me saying that Team Torres had 250 registered athletes, but only had 60-something that competed on the day, because I wasn't able to separate that through the registration list. However, the difference of 2 points in the overall affiliation trophy is very small, and it should be the encouragement maybe to other people, other gyms, other athletes to realize that one bronze medal would have made that a draw. One bronze medal would have made that a draw, and I do believe that two athletes from East Coast competed against each other and were determined to have been having a fake match, so both of them got disqualified. If they had it closed out, they would have got the points, they would have won the overall team affiliation as well as the adult gi and no gi awards. Anyway, they have won so many of them, I doubt it bothers them in the slightest, something like that. But it does go to show you that the margins are so small and that one medal really can make a difference. You get 2 points for a bronze, 6 for silver, you get 18 for a gold. For example, for female gi, Team Torres came third with 3 wins, 2 gold medals from 2 athletes. Okay? That can easily be replicated by another gym. Okay? Hill and Gracie came second with 3 wins and 1 loss, 2 gold medals and a bronze. Maze BJJ came first with 3 wins and 1 loss, 2 gold medals and a silver. So if you think within your gym there are girls, 3 girls who could win in the gi, the Irish Open next year, you would win the gi title for females. If the teams in 4th to 9th place had one more female gold medalist, they would have won the team title or be tied for third. In the Masters Nogi, these are just some examples, by the way. In the Masters Nogi, you had 3 people tied for first. East Coast, Checkmate, and Team Torres all were tied in first place for Masters Nogi with 92 points. East Coast had 7 wins, 11 losses. 3 gold, 4 silver, 7 bronze. Checkmate had 9 wins and 10 losses. 3 golds, 6 silvers, 1 bronze. Team Torres had 10 wins, 5 losses. 4 gold, 3 silver, 1 bronze. People came at me recently online because I said, you buy more tickets for the lotto, you have a higher chance of winning the lotto. This is just what I meant in that sense. And it's not to disparage against any other team or people with more people in it. You've completely missed the point of that. It's just based off probability and statistics that, like, one more Team Torres medal in a Nogi Masters division there would have put them first. Okay? Same for Checkmate, same for East Coast. Instead, we're all tied for first. Okay? So, really and truly, I can't stress it enough, this is such a good example of how one medal can make a difference. Just one medal or one entrant or one good win that puts you into the medals could make the difference. The egg is certainly on the face of those dastardly East Coast Jiu-Jitsu athletes with their affiliation lying in rules. Darragh O'Connell laughing his head off in Spain after allegedly abandoning his team, running off to the warm weather. We might have to put a pin in that narrative for one more year because they won the adults gi and no gi categories. And I think that they are the two hardest categories to win. The adult divisions are where the highest level of people are probably competing in, the hardest level of people to compete in. So congratulations to East Coast Gi and Nogi. Congratulations to Checkmate. They won the overall Academy Award, which includes kids, juveniles, teens, and adults and masters. They were the team that accumulated the most points across everything. And that is good to see them win that. That would have comprised of 3 different affiliations, Checkmate Dublin, Checkmate Waterford, and Barrog Jiu-Jitsu as well. And there is more that we could say, but that is definitely enough for the week. You can contact me through the Instagram page with any and all competition feedback. Thoughts would be nice. We might do a follow-up episode next week. What do you think? Should this system be a little bit different? Were you happy with how your team did? What do you think about the day itself? Who is the big winners? Who is the big losers? Blah, blah, blah. We can chat about it later in the week. Coaches or students is fine. It's all good. Anyone can get on to me. I'll field all questions. I do have some particular information for the next episode about how not a lot might have changed in 12 or 13 years when you think and step back and look at how the Irish Open is organised now compared to how it was then. But we are in such a good position now compared to then. And it is thanks to Barry, to Henrique and the rest of the organisers and staff for putting it on and running it to such a high level. Just so you know, I am not saying this against my will. This is not a paid statement or endorsement. But please keep in mind to all those listening out there that I am open to them appearing on this podcast in the future, in the sense of if anyone would like to give me paid endorsements or advertisements. No paid endorsement, too small or too large, will be looked over by the consistently above average admin team. I can guarantee you about that. All right. Thank you very much for tuning in. Episode 34 in the books. That was a long one. I'm away to training now to get absolutely lumped around the place because I've been sitting here in the one spot for the last hour and I'm stiff now. But chat to you next week. Episode 34 in the books. Good luck. Talk to you after.